This podcast is brought to you by Amusement Warehouse Magazine, the industry's largest trade publication. We cover amusement parks, carnivals, fairs, festivals, history, safety columns. We really got it all when it comes to the amusement business. Only remaining print publication in the amusement industry on a regular basis. So if you're interested in what the amusement industry has to offer, subscribe today. You can subscribe by logging on to amusementwarehouse.com, carnivalwarehouse.com, or amusementparkwarehouse.com. Welcome to another edition of Amusement Warehouse Podcast. Today, our guest is Rob Burke. You're technically president emeritus, I read, right? Is that true?
Something like that, yeah.
President emeritus of Burke Concession Supply. You've drank or ate or done anything about an amusement park or midway. You probably touched one of your products, right, Rob?
You got it. We were the innovators way back when.
So your business started like your family had like a pest control business was the first thing or some kind of pet?
We had three different companies. My dad was a coin dealer. Huh. We had also a pest control company. So we went around spraying for bugs and all that kind of thing in people's homes and businesses. And then we had another division called Burke Paper. So Burke Paper was paper towels, toilet tissue, cups, napkins. And we carried some janitorial supplies as well. Yeah. So it kind of started from that. And just a lead into what happened. So when I got out of college in the mid 70s, I started hitting all the county fairs like anyone liked to do. And I saw all these generic cups everywhere. So it just kind of made an impression on me. And when I started walking the fairgrounds, all the concessionaires were buying from all of our local competitors. But they were using, the lemonade guys were using what Sweetheart Cup called the wheat design cup. It was just a generic looking cup. And being
just like white plain cups back then or?
Yeah, just very generic cups. They'd use that. They'd use closeout cups. They'd use styrofoam cups. You know, there was no talk or even thinking of having something customized. It was only the largest of the large guys that did it, but 90% of the guys did not. They were all mom and pop operations. And I saw an opportunity. So several years into it, let's say maybe the early 80s, I came up with the lemonade design. I don't have a picture of that. Maybe you do from your end. But it was a design that was unique for that industry. And every lemonade guy that I came to, at least in our neck of the woods, Don Huber was one of the biggest guys. He used to buy 100 cases at a time. Well, to me, 100 cases was massive. And I showed him the cup, and the guy went crazy. But the one thing I don't have with me, and let me see if I can find it, but in our catalog, we had it showed the growth of the lemonade design over the years. But in the beginning, it was just the words lemonade around the cup. And at the time, that was still unique. The lemonade guy. So they said, I want that cup. And from there, it developed into the design that we use today. And it was the start of something that little did I know how big it would become because I started getting people that wanted to buy our products from coast to coast. I never heard of half these concessionaires because in Northeast Ohio, you had Bates around here and the Ottobocker family. And they were the big players. So they were the ones that started buying our product. And next thing you know, I started getting people reaching out to me from all over the U.S.
That's pretty neat. You know, when people think of things that just, I guess it's right in front of them, but they don't think about what could be. And you did. That's really, and that's just the start of it. I mean, you're just touching the tip of the iceberg, had the idea that sparked it. But, you know, people are like, okay, I guess like bottled water, like who the heck thought to put water in a bottle? You know, it's crazy when people first did it, like, why am I going to pay to have water in a bottle? I remember first time I ever had it. I was like, that's nuts. I could get it in the fountain, but
Well, you know, you for me, what was crazy, there was a big operator out of Cleveland called Bob Baker, and he had a Bob's Fresh Lemonade, and I said, boy, I'd love to sell you. No, I'm buying from this guy in Cleveland. He's been my distributor from day one, and he, like myself, we were distributors for Solo Cup. That was the cup company back then, either Solo or Sweetheart. And Bob Baker said, you know, Rob, a good guy, but I've been with Barry for years and years, the company in Cleveland, and I saw he was using a cup. He was using a plastic cup, and he wanted to get a plastic cup with his name on it, Bob's Fresh Lemonade. And at the time, he wouldn't buy the paper cup for me, the 16-ounce squat, but he said, I would consider buying a 32-ounce plastic cup from you. And I was excited about the opportunity, so I printed for him. Well, little did I know that this is the beginning of the rush of the industry to start upselling their lemonades from a $3 sell on the paper cup to a $5 sell on the plastic cup. And thanks to Bob Baker, I used the idea of the 32-ounce cup and put my design on it. And this is the print for all those out there in TV land. But this is the print that, you know, kind of put our name on the map as the as a design that really stood up. Because like I told so many people early on, especially those that use a foam cup or a generic cup, I said, do me a favor. So I'd grab, even down in Gift Town, I'd grab a generic cup and I'd walk halfway down the aisle there. And I said, can you see this cup? It was a generic cup. No. So then I put that cup on the table and grabbed this cup. And I said, can you see that cup? And they said, yeah. So I said, the idea being when people are walking with that cup, they think lemonade. And then they're going to ask, hey, where did you get that drink from? The guy right behind me down the road there, he had it. So that people start realizing that, and I kind of came up with a slogan, flash is cash. They start realizing that, hey, there's something about this guy that maybe he's onto something. Because a lot of the guys, the larger operators, you know, they always had great trailers and they put flowers and lighting around their trailers and neon signs and whatnot. But no one really looked at the packaging aspect of it. And that was where my strength was. And even today, there's a lot of people that dabble in the packaging and put most of their strengths are in food service. But our strength has always been the packaging. And I came up with this concept of and many concepts with the lemons, lemons on a rope. We sold for a long time. I remember seeing Bobby Pugh from Ryhopper shows. He come to Gift Town every year. And he says, where's your ropes? And he'd buy, I don't know, 25 or 50. Debbie and Bob Pugh would go crazy and buy these lemon ropes and vegetables on a rope. But the idea being that it flashed up the trailer and it attracted people to your stand. I mean, ultimately, that's what you guys want to do to bring more of an audience. So over time, more and more, we introduced our products and offered opportunities for a lot of concessionaires to print their products. And the whole concept of printing was like crazy. I can't afford to get 100,000 cups. I said, well, with the plastic cup, all you need is 5,000. So it was nothing, and it really came in the map, and we were selling custom printed cups throughout the Midway and all over the place. And at that time, I was obsessed with getting business started because we were no one knew about who was Burke was. It was all the Cisco's or Gordon Foods or whoever's a local food provider. But I remember the one particular year I hit 5 state fairs in 10 days. And I brought a backpack, and all I did was filled up with all our products. And people looked at it, and some said, wow, this is great. Some said, oh, it's too much money or whatever. I remember one particular guy said, oh, no, why would I pay – well, this is at the time anyways, but why would I pay 4 cents for a paper cup with your design on it when I can buy a closeout for 2? And I said, I'll tell you what, I'm going to send you – because this guy used to buy 10 cases at the time, he told me. I said, I'm going to send you, what was it, maybe 4 or 5 sleeves at no charge. Just try them out. Well, the guy trying them out, I guess he sold out those five sleeves within a day for whatever reason. But he said, you know what? I'm sold. I can't believe it. But you were right. This design helps sell the product. So I always thought I was an innovator in the industry. And for some of the younger people listening in on this, you know, everything in life starts with somebody, some pioneer. And I was the guy that kind of started and created the idea of packaging unique for your particular business. And we went into packaging paper plates and the individual deli wraps. So, you know, the list goes on and on. And if it's made out of paper or plastic, you know, we can customize it. And it really upscales the look of your operation. And that's kind of been our MO from the very beginning.
Yeah, you mentioned the Otterbacher before, but, you know, the trailers themselves kind of went through that metamorphosis too, probably in the 90s, because they were just plain white trailers. Like, you had a Chance trailer, it was white with red lettering, and that was it. And then, you know, somebody might flash it up with some neon or something like that. But then, you know, Gary and some of the other big trailer manufacturers started to make these beautiful designs with the marquees and the big marquees, and that changed the game too. So it seemed like you guys were almost, I mean, not working in tandem, but you kind of both had the push to really sell things and make things more exciting for concessionaires. It must have been an exciting time.
I remember Dave Campbell had a trailer down to Gibtown one year. It had like two floors, but the second floor like popped up or something. And I said, man, how do you come up with these crazy ideas? But, you know, everyone's trying to outdo the next guy. And what can they do to create something that attracts the crowd? I mean, some of these trailers nowadays with the signage is just, it's amazing. It's like a billboard.
Yeah.
But, the idea being that, hey, let's attract someone to my trailer, not the guy next door. And between that and our packaging, you know, it makes the complete package and makes these people stand out over the others. So
about the commemorative cups? Those have become so huge. Did you have a role in starting something like the welcome to this specific fair or,
we custom printed just about everything, you know, for individuals to fairs, of course. We did the Texas State Fair with the big Tex on the topper.
Right.
So, you know, the sky's the limit to what can be done. And,
but that was pretty revolutionary, though, because people weren't going to buy cups just for one event. You know, that seemed crazy, right? I mean, some people, the resistors probably said something like that.
One of my better selling points was in our area, the largest county fair is Canfield Fair.
Yeah.
They were celebrating, it was either their 100th or 150th year anniversary, whatever it was. So I said, why don't you use a custom printed cup and make all the concessionaires buy the cups from you? So, you know, I charge them X and then they charge X times 20% or whatever it was. And, but, you know, that's another thing that could be done as far as the fair owners is they can come up with a design and ask the concessionaires to use this design exclusively for our fair to promote our fair. And not all concessionaires are real keen on that because some people like to promote their product and so forth. But everyone's got a different take on this, on the custom printed products. And, you know, overall, it's there's something fun about it. And like you're suggesting, people start collecting these cups. So the fair goers will go to a state fair and every year they'll have a certain cup that's unique for that year. And the next thing you know, people are coming back to the fair and say, hey, what's your cup this year? I want to buy it, add it to my collection. I mean, everyone collects everything. I collect pinball machines.
I know. That's amazing.
So, you know, everyone, their clock ticks differently. But
I was hoping you're going to do the podcast from the pinball machine room.
That'll come up either today or next week. But that's been a lot of fun doing the pinball deal. But, you know, I guess when you're a promoter, you kind of understand concepts and ideas. The Brick Concession Supply was my idea and the custom printed product and so forth. I do this pinball show. It's going on its 40th year. Again, this was my idea. So I've always been an idea guy. What's that?
You promote it? You're the promoter of the pinball machine show?
Pinball Expo. It's my show, yeah.
Oh, no way.
So, you know, it's in my blood, promotion in my blood, and I see opportunities. But, you know, whenever I do something, I don't go halfway, I go all the way. And just, I want to make sure that people get a great experience in whatever we do so that they feel they're getting their money's worth. So the pinball thing has been a lot of fun. We will digress a bit, but the pinball show started out of Chicago, which is the home of pinball. And that was the first year I did that show. And the idea was to do it one time only to recognize and honor my heroes who were the pinball designers. Because I always felt growing up, man, this game was great. I love this game, or I love this company. And I thought to myself, you know, these guys are 9-to-5 guys for the most part, but the only guys that get the recognition are the owners of Bally or the owners of Williams or Gottlieb or whatever the different companies were. And I said to myself, it's about time someone recognizes the true heroes who were the designers that laid out the play fields of these games. So I did the show, and it was a resounding success. And I remember I had four guys come up front, and I said, ladies and gentlemen, these four guys are responsible for designing over 600 pinball machines. So everyone stood up and applauded. And by everybody, we had 100 people the first show. This past year, we had over 6,000 to give you an idea how the show's grown. Probably. But when they stood up, a lot of these guys had tears in their eyes because they weren't used to these accolades.
They were recognized.
And they were finally recognized. So to me, it was so satisfying and gratifying. And to me, it was a one-and-done event. And about 6 months into the following year, people started saying, when's your next show? I said, well, there is no next show. I did what I wanted to do. And they said, oh, no, this show was too much fun. Do one more. All right, one more. Well, this last year was our 40th year, so we're still doing it.
40th year. So, what's your favorite pinball machine?
That's a tough one. Probably Medium of Madness is one, or Theater of Magic and Medium of Madness, I think, are my favorite. But, you know, everyone out there, even people listening to this broadcast, you know, there's like Kiss was always a favorite for a lot of people.
Yeah, I got a buddy who collects the rock ones. He's in the rock shop, and he
Captain Fantastic was a popular one back in the day. But by the way, I do buy pinball machines. If you got one in your basement, give me a call. But anyways, it's so crazy. You know, I start buying these games and buying more and buying more and buying more. So I told my daughter one time, just off the cuff, I said, boy, I wonder, you know, who's got the most pinball machines, you know, even though I knew I had a lot of them. So she spent 2 years documenting every game I purchased and I owned and presented it to Guinness. And about a year ago, we were doing a live presentation on TV from a local TV station. And then my wife says, hold on, press, don't leave yet. And she presented me this plaque from the Guinness people, recognizing me as having the largest collection of pinball machines. So it was over 1,000, 1,040, I think, at the time. It's probably 1,100 now. Still buying them. But
where do you keep them?
Well, you know, what I did was I opened up an arcade, and I called the arcade Pastimes. But in the arcade, we have over 600 games set up between pinballs and video machines. So for those that are in the video, like the Pac-Mans, Donkey Kong, Centipede, all these
Gorf,
games.
I like Gorf.
Gorf, got it. Galaga, whatever.
You don't see it too bad. Galaga's my other favorite. I love that one.
Yeah. But so when you walk into this arcade, there's 600 games. So you pay $20 and you play till you drop.
Oh, so I mean, you play.
It's a bargain. But wow. That was also, you know, I don't know what it is, but, you know, when I go with something, I go full blast. And the arcade, Pastimes Arcade, we have people come not only from all over the U.S., but all over the world to see this massive collection. Because there's more and more pinball fanatics out there, more than people would even realize. And like any hobby, there's some people that are really passionate about it. And they've been to Pastimes and see these games, and they walk shaking their head, man, this was an experience of a lifetime. And I have some younger kids saying, man, this place is great. I love it here. So that's always fun to see that. But
there are a couple of those cool little arcades like Mr. Magorum, or isn't there something like in Michigan that's a pretty famous.
Yeah, I know him. Marvin's Magical, whatever.
Yeah, that's what it is. And he's got cool, like, sideshow stuff up on the wall and different things.
Yeah, I knew Marvin.
Where I've been to.
Yeah. So Marvin's passed away, but his son's running it now. But the local mall has made them move out of there. They're putting another. So that business has been there forever. So I think they're moving to a new location. But, you know, being in the entertainment industry, whether it be myself with the Burke Concession or the pinball, it's a fun industry to be in. And it brings a smile to your face, to put it bluntly.
Yes. And the stuff you're involved in is crazy. So, with the souvenir cups and doing all those things, you also got into like, what about like the buckets for popcorn and stuff like that? Like they just had generic things before.
Yeah, that's good. Right? That's a good question. So, let me see if I can get my little dog here to be quiet. Pep. So, let me think of this gentleman's name. There's a guy out of Pennsylvania, Rick. Let me think of his last name so we can make sure we cover all our bases. Hold on, not there. We'll give you the guy's name. Rick Schneider. So Rick Schneider has had a business in the middle of Pennsylvania and a very big operator of French fries. And I went to visit him on the fairs, and I see he's putting French fries in a paper ice cream bucket. I said, what are you doing, Rick? Hold on, guys. I'm sorry. Hold on 1 second.
Rob Burke heads to silence his dog. As long as we don't hear any weird noises, I guess we're okay. Yeah. There's the dog.
That was a chance for you guys to play a commercial, by the way. So anyways, so Rick Schneider is using ice cream buckets for large orders of fries, paper ice cream bucket. And he bragged about it. He said, the local distributor would sell me all the misprint ice cream buckets. And I said, that's wild, man. I can't believe people buy a bucket of fries. And he said, yeah. He said, we sell them like crazy. Well, there, you know, the wheels start turning again. And I said, So I came up with this concept of bucket of fries. I had a design that we created and put a handle on it because the paper bucket you would just carry with your hand. And I sold it locally with a guy by the name of Doug Roman. He was one of the first guys in our area to try it. And at the time, you know, you're getting $3 to $5 for an order of fries. So he was charged, I think it was either $8 or $10 for the bucket of fries. And, he would flash the buckets in his trailer. And in the beginning, I remember the first year he had it, you know, people just looked at it, but doggone, once in a while, he sold one here and then one there. And then the next thing you know, the bucket of fries became a mainstay in the industry. I mean, you see them all over the place now. So we've used that bucket for donuts. We've used that bucket for nachos. We use those buckets for
popcorn.
Not popcorn. They're too small for popcorn, but just about everything from A to Z. And it's been a very, very popular item. But, you know, I want to relate another story for those that can remember way back when. But there was a guy out of Cleveland by the name of Al Bozich. And he was a medium-sized operator, but mostly selling pizza and so forth. Well, there was a guy in Canada came by the name of Hanson Marketing, and they came up with a bottle called the Next Generation. Now, at the time, the only bottles or cups you would see is the 32-ounce cup like we see today. But this was a clear blown bottle. The process was called blow molding, where it's like the half yarders you guys see, the half yarders or the alien bottle. It's a formed bottle. And he had this bottle called the Next Generation. Well, to see this in the sample kit from this company, I said, what in the world is this goofy looking thing? Who in the world's going to buy this? Well, I start showing around, and people that you know, where their drinks was such a small part of their business said, let me try it. Well, I brought it 100 cases, And I think I sold out of them in less than a week or two. Couldn't believe it. I said, what do you guys see in this next generation bottle? So for those who know Joe Beatrice, you can ask him about this too, because it blew everyone's mind. So the next generation bottle was just nuts. Now, I remember Dave Campbell from Degler Amusements. He says, I want as many cases as you can pump out to me. So there was a time he was buying, he was either 50 or 100 cases a week. As much as I can get, I could send to him, I could send to him. And what happened was this manufacturer, because I guess because of the process of making this item, it couldn't withhold a lot of heat in the manufacturing complex. So there was only a certain quantity they could make at any given time. And the demand far exceeded the supply. And this guy with the next generation bottle, he was the only manufacturer of this bottle. And I was selling, like I said, an awful lot of them to Dave Campbell at Degler. And the local guys, the Ottobockers and whatnot, really got ticked off at me. Hey, man, I want that bottle. I want 10 cases. And next thing I know, I you know, only 100 cases would show up at the door from the manufacturer, maybe 200. So I had to start splitting them up. Okay, I'll send you 3 cases. I'll send you 8. I'll send you, 10 or whatever. So there's a lot of people unhappy with me during that time. And, we just had to deal with it. But it was just another stage of this whole concession industry where, our company introduced really out of this world packaging. And the next generation was one of them that put our name in the map. I mean, I got a phone call from people I never heard of before. I said, where are you located again? Connecticut. I mean, we're in Ohio. How'd you even hear about us? Well, I saw your bottle, blah, 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 blah. So it was a crazy time. But it really put our name on the map between that and the lemonade cup that people that never heard about us, they heard about our products. So that helped catapult Burke Paper at the time. And I made the decision to call the company Burke Concession because Burke Paper to me was the name that my dad used. But the paper products were typically paper towels, toilet tissue. When you think paper, or you think office supplies,
right?
Burke Paper. So I said, it doesn't really tell us who we are. So that I kind of came with the name change to Burke Concession Supply, which more clearly defines what we do. But that was some of the early stories, guys.
What year was that for the next generation cup?
The next generation bottle.
Approximately.
Somewhere in the 80s.
80s.
Yeah. And maybe late 80s, early 90s. But this same company also made the Coke Bear. I don't know if anyone remembers that, but they had a Coke Bear. It was a 32-ounce cup where the head screwed off and the straw was in the middle of the head. And that was also a very popular item for a while. And then that just kind of petered out. But between myself and Joe Beatrice with the company he had at the time, we were pumping out bottles like crazy to the industry, and they couldn't get enough of these plastic bottles. And it really opened up a whole new avenue for the smallest concessionaire. They would start carrying these bottles and start seeing sales beyond their wildest dreams, selling drinks. Sometimes their main business was funnel cake or elephant ears or pizza. But then all of a sudden people said, forget that. I want that cup. Give me that drink because I want that cup. So that was happening. And then, the half yarders and every design of half yarders, we have a full lineup of these products in our catalog. But, there's just never enough product. You think you've covered all the bases and someone comes up with something new. For a while, we were doing the lighted bottles where the bottom would light up. And those are really cool. But what happened was, if the inventory sat around too long, the batteries would
die out.
Yeah, so, that didn't last too long because the batteries was an issue.
I think I read you have over 4,000 products in your catalog that you sell or something like that.
Well, that's as of last count, but... you try to have everything for everyone, and we try our best to do that.
It's like pinball machines, they just keep accumulating.
Yep. The The one thing we have with the, I have with the pinballs is a lot of people remember maybe a pinball machine called the Addams Family.
Oh yeah.
There's certain titles that everyone seems to know or remember. But the one thing I've done with my museum is I have a whole aisle just with pinball machines that were made from either Italy or France or Brazil or Australia.
Really?
And you'll see games at this arcade that you will see anywhere in the world because no one has the breadth of games that I have. So it's just the way I'm wired. Whenever I get into something, I go full steam ahead and have amassed collections that are just out of this world, so to speak.
You know, it's fascinating, this industry, is people like you. I interviewed Jimmy Drew not too long ago. He has the largest band organ music collection in the world.
Oh, my gosh.
It's unbelievable. Like, you know, it's these things that people have or the interest they get in addition to our industry and the things that they do is fascinating. There's just so many people into whatever they're into, and then they're really good at it too, whatever that might be. And then you with pinball certainly is a thing. And as we said, Jimmy Drew with the music and the band organs, restoring antique things. Corky Powers loves to do that too, restore things. It's really interesting, the sideline that people have.
I think would be fun for you is to bring your cameras down to either me or Corky's place or Drew, whatever, and go get some video behind the scenes. You know,
so yeah, the pinball that place would be a lot of fun there.
Oh my gosh, you'll lose your mind. For those of you that have nothing to do, it's www.pasttimesarcade.com.
And where is it?
What's that?
Where is it?
Well, it's in Girard, Ohio, which is near Youngstown. But you can look up on the website pasttimesarcade.com, and you'll see some video of the arcade, and it'll blow your mind. It's just crazy. You know, when you walk in there, there's this wow factor. Like, where do I start? And, you know, also in the arcade, I have a several of the what we call the pre-flipper games. The pinballs were made from the 1930s before there were flippers. But a lot of these pinballs were made in our backyard here in Youngstown, Ohio. So, it's a walk in time, to be honest with you. And then we have some of the old pitch and bat baseballs, some of the old gun games. So, you know, anyone that remembers the glorious years, we'll see a lot of fun stuff.
And you serve concessions there, I hope?
Oh, yeah. So my wife and daughter came up with the idea of doing milkshakes, so that's been a big part of it.
Oh, but that's neat. That's nostalgic.
But it's not soft serve. It's, you know, the hard ice cream. So you got to sit there and dig it out, and it takes some time, but it's been one of our top sellers.
No, there's something about Ohio. It's really it fascinated me because I've talked to Gary Ottobacher and other Jeff Pugh when he was around and people like that. But there's something with Ohio with the amusement business where I remember when I first came into the industry, it seemed like every trailer manufacturer was from, I mean, not every, of course, but there were so many though from Ohio. You had, you know, Gary was doing it, and there was Molnar, and there was a bunch of different manufacturers, all from Ohio. And then there were a couple, you got ride manufacturers with ARM and carnivals from all over the place. But there, you know, generally there's some story behind it, why it grew up in the area, but nobody seems to really know why.
Yeah,
I've heard they have a strong independent fair concessionaire thing, and yeah, that's all true, but there's got to be something more to it, because it's just so weird how so many manufacturers, yourself and Majestic, how could I forget, Vince will yell at me. Forget about all those places that came from Ohio. It's weird how places like that crop up in different areas in the United States, but Ohio really seems to be a real rich land for that sort of thing.
You know, what surprises me is the concessionaires, the amount of money they'll pump out to buy these trailers. It's just unbelievable. But then
the gift town that were just mind blowing. I remember because I used to do some advertising for Gary back in the day. And the knock, you know, used to be that his big trailers are expensive, you know. But at that time, we made that ad for AB. I don't know if you remember. It said too expensive in big, bold letters with the question mark on the end. We designed that ad. It kind of hit the thing head on. But those trailers were approaching, you know, a couple hundred thousand. And people were losing their minds. Now, forget it. It's unbelievable.
It's amazing. I can't even imagine. But then again, the concessionaires must see a profit at the end of the day that makes them spend that kind of money. Because, well, not only that, but the competition can kill you. I mean, if you have one of the basic trailers made back in the 60s or 70s that were just a shell, basically, and then you're next to a guy with all these lights and horns and whatever else you want to call it, it's like, I don't have a chance. Either I buy a trailer like this guy's got, or I'm dead. No use, you know, I might as well just pack it up. So
yeah, same with concession packaging with your items. I mean, to flash it and to get your name out in the midway. You know, it's just like when somebody wins a plays a game or they win a certain stuffed animal, people go, where'd you get that? Where'd you get that? Where'd you get that? And that's a big, you know, that word of mouth is big. Like, because I'm sure you're going for that too with the lemonade or with French fries or whatever you're selling. Where do you get that?
Yeah.
And then they follow themselves back to the trailer that you were.
You know, it's interesting to see some of the new developments in the food industry too, some of the different things. You know, I think the Florida State Fair is in Minnesota, the state fair, you see some of the most craziest things. I remember, I think it was Florida that had the hamburgers made with the Krispy Kreme donut and all these crazy things. They're fun. I don't know how much these guys made money on some of this stuff, but
well, that's the thing, right? It sometimes you do that just for the pre-fair publicity to put something out. I don't know. It's not necessarily a big, although Pickle Pizza became a huge seller too. But
crazy,
it is crazy, and I didn't think it'd be good. But Rick Uckmar was the one I tried it from, and he's Italian and a good pizza maker. But it wasn't that bad, honestly. I was shocked because I thought it was gonna be terrible.
Yeah, but, there was a pizza on the stick. I mean, there was all these different things. But, you know, again, the packaging. So anyone that has an idea, you know, you can flash it and show it. But if you got the packaging to go with it, it helps sell the concept, the idea, and makes it even more enticing to buy the product.
I got two questions. One is, so you started, I mean, obviously Ohio, right, with building your base around Ohio, and then you expanded out through the rest of the country sort of kind of. And was that mostly through word of mouth, or did you visit, or Gibbtown, or what, you know?
Well, Gibbtown was the golden goose. You know, everyone went to Gibbtown at the time. It was a massive show, and mostly for the concession industry, you know, and the carnivals. And it was a great show, great networking. Some of the luminaries I remember was Little Richard.
Yeah.
You know, and I remember I used to go to Gibbtown, and I'd hear about some of these big operators, and I remember going to Gibbtown, and everyone that came to my booth and says, hey, who's this Little Richard guy? Tell him I want to see him. So it was like day two or day three of Gibbtown, and he shows up with all his bling. He said, everyone tells me I'm everywhere I go. People says, you want to see me? Who are you? And I said, I want to sell my products, which I end up doing. But you know, that's how it was in the earlier. I didn't know half these guys, Vivona, all these guys. And I said, I want to meet you guys. And they come to Gibbtown. I mean, everyone came to Gibbtown back then. But for your viewing audience, I want you to remember one thing that Little Richard said. He used to hand out a pen and it says, don't forget your friends going up the ladder because you might need them when you come down. I remember he would always push that little statement. But there were some fun guys, you know, in the industry back then. There was a lot of interesting characters and all fun people. And, you know, the Gibbtown was a lot of fun. I mean, I remember Gibbtown, I think it was 6 or 7 days in the early years. And way in the early years, when we first heard about it in the early 80s, I couldn't get into Gibbtown. It was sold out.
Really?
And it was just they had the one building only. And then they got so many people that wanted to come to Gibbtown. They opened up. They had a tent outside. So I was there at Gibbtown the first year they had the tent. And it rained there, and there was mud on the ground. And it was crazy. But I got introduced to the industry and meeting some of these people. And Gibbtown was always a fun time for us. And you know, we always had a show special there and meeting a lot of people. There was just so much energy that you can't copy it. I mean, you got the IAPA show, and yeah, a lot of concessionaires go there, but it was a different kind of energy because Gibbtown was a love-in. Everyone hugging everybody and meeting everybody and just nothing was presumptuous. No suit and tie. We'd just go casual with shorts or whatever, and It just, everyone just was there all for the same good of the industry and seeing their friends.
Yeah, it's nice. This year was actually a great year at Gibtown. It was a lot of, I know some of the ride manufacturers, one person sold, these are not cheap rides. You're talking about serious, serious money. I think they sold 9 pieces at Gibtown. I mean, yeah. And she said she was expecting to sell more. I was like, how many rides are you going to sell at, you know, $800,000 at that kind of price? But they just, you know, a lot of people did really, really well. It did, definitely the character and the tenors changed a little bit, but you know, people still do a lot of business there, a lot of business. It's just, and you mentioned it, and it might be your fault actually, but with all the custom stuff, it makes it very difficult to, you know, bring stuff on spec and things like, because now everybody wants things customized. They want lights, they want paint, they want, you know, they don't want to, you know, whatever. Matt'll yell at me because I bring this up all the time, but they just don't want a red tilt-a-whirl anymore. You know, they want, you know, purple bonnets and this thing and that thing. So you can't just bring stuff like you used to, like you said, so show special. And I remember in my early years going there where, you know, there were rides that were left for the last day, and then the carnival owners would run around and kind of lowball the manufacturers trying to steal something real cheap, you know. And yeah, I don't think those days are around, but it's still very, it's amazing. The amount of business that gets done there is pretty amazing. It really is.
Well, let's face it, for guys like me from Ohio, it was great to be there just for the weather alone. So.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And the atmosphere was just—it was a fun atmosphere. Plus, they had their museum there across the street. So, you know, I go back before that museum was even around, where they were taking money for that museum. So, lots changed. A lot of people have changed. Management's changed, but you know, life goes on, guys. You got to keep moving forward.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So reaching, becoming nationwide, and going to Canada and things like that. Must have been an interesting, you know, getting to meet new people and I guess you touch base with them at Gibtown or someplace or go to visit them or something. And you got concessionaires too, so you got a ton of different people. What about the park business? Did you expand?
We're getting into park business more and more, and it's been an interesting industry because it's a little bit different than the carnival industry or that we have, you know, here in Gibtown, but. You know, more of a suit and tie, more of a professional presentation, more of a sometimes placing a bid and competing with other people.
Right.
And
the purchasing process is longer, I imagine.
Oh yeah, and it's unique. So
I talk to ride guys about that all the time, because I'm kind of fascinated how, you know, how different it is. Because like a, you know, you might go see a carnival owner. And you're selling the same ride, you know, whatever. It's a, you know, $1 million or something like that. But the carnival owner, man, the flip of a, you know, thought or whatever, decide to go buy it right then. But I imagine most parks anyway. I mean, there's privately owned parks and smaller parks. But, right. You know, these bigger parks, it's a process. It takes forever. And like you say, you got to make presentations and do things. That must be a pain.
Well, yeah, not that. But sometimes either you're not one of the good old boys, so, you know, you don't get a shot at it, or they... They smile at you that when you leave, they throw your quote away. So
sure.
We deal with that too. You know, our company is, we have another division that sells packaging to the food service industry. Like we sell the bowl that they use at Chipotle. So, you know, we're used to dealing with, you know, we're used to dealing with, you know, large corporations. And so it was no big mystery hitting some of these, state fairs and talking to management out there. So we're used to it. It's kind of in our MO. So it was nothing unusual, but you know, a lot of times you got to sell yourself. They like you, you're in, you know, it's like anything. I never liked you, but I like you now. So I figured, okay, I'll do the podcast, but you know what I'm saying? Awesome. You're a good guy. Good things happen. I was telling my kids, be good. Good things happen. Think negative things happen. So always think positive, and at the end of the day, things will work out.
What are some of the newer innovations you've been involved with the concession business? I know you had that environmental line. I'm sure that goes big in certain places. And
yeah, that's not so much an innovation, though, but it's an interesting topic because more and more fairs don't want plastic. Mm-hmm. And this also includes Canada, and it especially also Canada, includes, yeah, England. So You know, we try to get some inroads into England as well, and that's what we found. So it's interesting because there are environmentally free or environmentally friendly products, but they're not cheap. It's like the straws. You know, for a while there, Timmy the turtle had that straw in his nose. Now the whole country is against plastic straws. But what's happened is the cost of the paper straws is so crazy.
And they're terrible. I hate drinking out of a paper straw. I'll leave the restaurant if they have a stupid.
Yeah, they're just, they're no good. So, you know, now that the mandate on plastic straws is kind of going away and people are kind of getting back into the, or the paper straws is going away. So people are getting back into plastic. I mean, to drink a drink, I know for a while there, they were selling a stainless steel straw.
Yeah.
And they show a picture of the mother taking the straw out of her purse. I don't know how they cleaned it or whatever. And then gave it to Junior. And then when he was done with it, I guess they went back in the purse. I don't know. But they tried plastic straws. The one company was promoting straws. Ready, guys? Made out of pasta. So, you know, a long pasta tube. And they were promoting that as a straw. You know,
viral. All those extra carbs.
What's that?
It said all those extra carbs.
Oh, yeah. But they had straws that were made like a, what do you call those? It was like a hard candy, but they tried to make a straw out of that.
Really?
Plastic
is like the perfect invention, unfortunately.
It's smooth. It's small. It's packaging. It's just convenient.
And, yeah, but my mom actually is still on the town council back in New Jersey. Our town, and she's trying to ban plastic bags or something. My son was going to her, Grandma, you know, to use those reusable bags, you have to wash them every single time to be sanitary. And those people are not washing them every time. You say it's better, but it's not better because people aren't doing it. Like you said,
so what she said, it's a good point.
You know, she's like, well, I killed it at a sea lion or something crazy.
Give me her number. I'll call her too.
Yeah, but, that's like the one issue she's nuts about. Everything else, she's fine. But that one, the plastic bag, because I go to the store with her, you know, we go shopping or something. And I said, oh, can I have a plastic bag, please? And the guy goes, oh, I'm sorry, they're not allowed to use them in this town. I said, I know. See her? She's the one.
There you go. Good. But, yeah, packaging, there's been ups and downs of packaging and hitting all sectors of industries. Not only the concession industry and the amusement industry, but that's a good point though about the straws. And now, you know, the other issue is some people want compostable product.
Yeah.
Why? Because it goes back to the earth. What's the hangup? It's finding land that will accept your compostable product, or finding someone that's going to sit there and separate them. So as you know, a lot of places have three bins. You know. Compostable, non-compostable, right. Plastic, this food, that food, or whatever. The trouble is, most of us don't even look at the label. We just throw whatever we got, whatever is the most convenient can. So even though it's a compostable can, you know, there's foil in there, plastic, whatever. So, you know, someone's going to sit there and separate them. So, you know, it's just the mindset of the people and of the community to try to promote these ideas because – just the whole concept of composting in landfill is not that easy.
No, it's not. When I was a kid, I guess, I was in like high school, we used to have a recycling program in my town in New Jersey. And then there was an article in the Wall Street Journal, it was like a scandal, because they were just taking the stuff and putting it back together after everybody was separating it and dumping it in the landfill because they couldn't get rid of it. You know, they couldn't sell it. It was too expensive. So they were just, you know, everybody's going through this whole fiction of separating, and then they would just come and dump it all back together and throw it in a landfill. It was nuts. But
you know, I always thought Japan had the greatest idea going, and that was to incinerate. So you know, some people say you know it throws fumes in the air and whatever. But what's a better way of getting rid of it? I mean, you know,
they do that a lot. You know,
leave. You know, you don't want to dump the stuff in the oceans. That'd be ridiculous. Yeah. And but some people do that. They either dump in the oceans or. Try to bury it, but you know, after a while, you run out of land to bury this stuff. I mean, they find stuff they dig up years, you know, 10, 20 years later that hasn't decomposed at all. So
you got to think these solutions it's all the way through. Issue, yeah. A lot of times there's negative consequences to you think you're doing something, but then if you don't wash your straw or you don't wash your bag, you get salmonella or something because you're carrying around pork juice.
I mean, I always liked the brown paper bags, man. That's how it was back in the day. They were convenient. They were strong. Bags.
So let's talk about your family. Riley is now in charge.
Yep.
She rule the roost pretty hard on you? She give you a daily to-do list? Or what's she doing with you?
She worked for another company for a while, a logistics company, and she learned from that. And then I said, you know, it's about time. Maybe you think about coming back to work for the family or coming to work for the family. And she had been to some of the early IAPA shows. We used to exhibit at IAPA in Europe. And that was an adventure in its own, the whole European market. But she went to the shows and she said, this is my life. This is my future, Dad. I like working for the family and being part of the family business. So of all the kids, she kind of grabbed it and ran with it. And she came to the company, and she showed a lot of leadership skills. And as the old saying goes, my get up and go has gone up and went. So hers was still, young girl, so a lot of energy and a lot of ideas, hopefully good ideas. So we kind of made her CEO. And I was okay with that because, I mean, ideally you want to turn things over to the family over a stranger. And I said, hey, I'm here for you. I can help guide you. And kind of the same thing with my dad. But my dad was ill at the time when he was kind of stepped down. But he was still a phone call away. But, you know, for a family, that kind of helps to ask, hey, how do you do this? How do you do this? What happens when this happens? Where do you go to? So, you know, I'm here for her. But she's learning along the way. And she's building relationships. I mean, she's had a very strong relationship with Debbie Powers. Debbie's helped her.
That's get a good person to have a good relationship with.
Yeah, helping to get into OABA. So, you know, she enjoys this industry because she grew up in this industry and hitting all these
fairs. The carnival side of things?
Yeah.
So yeah, my daughter works too, and she kind of, I mean, at first she was a little, weirded out by it, but she loves it. She really loves it.
You know, how can you not like the music industry? It's so much fun. The one thing I miss, though, you know, I miss the Sideshow Barkers. And there was the fellow that was down at Gibtown for forever. I'm trying to think of his name right now.
Ward Hall?
Thank you, sir. So I was so impressed by Ward, I asked him to speak at our Rotary Club. So I flew him in to little old Warren, Ohio. And you know, here we got a Barker here. And I said, Ward, do me a favor. I said, grab one of the people here in the audience and let's do something. So he'd have this person in my front, and he says, here we are in front of you, the normal-looking person. But this person eats, 15 pounds of bacon and this and that and everything. But he had a great way of promoting himself, and he was a colorful guy. And another colorful part of Gibtown is gone. But, we met him in Gibtown, and it's just interesting to look at the walls of Gibtown and all these different people that were involved in the industry. Oh. But, I mean, that guy was a living legend. I mean, it's another part of America that's – it's gone because, I mean, these sideshows have all gone away. So,
the shows in general, I mean, I've been doing a lot of studying of the history of the carnival business. I've read the Conklin book and all those things. Because the carnivals were mostly shows until whatever, the 50s or 60s before you started getting these big rides. And then as it become more corporatized, and I guess, it parallels kind of what you're describing with the characters of the business too. It's kind of, the sons or daughters of some of these people that used to own carnivals are not quite as, wild or whatever, as little characters as they used to be. And certainly, I mean, there's still plenty of color in our business, but, it's become more and more corporate in some ways. And I don't say corporate in a negative way. It's just, there's a lot of regulations you got to follow. There's a lot of things you got to do. You got to be a serious business operator to operate a show of any size anymore. So it's not like it's a seat of your pants, run down the road and see what happens type of thing anymore.
And you know what else? In the same vein, you got to be on top of your game.
You do.
You can lose market share very quickly from a competitor and in any aspect of it. So, like anything in life, you got to be on top of your game and always be innovative and creative in whatever you do.
Yeah, so, there's no question about it. Yep. There's but I think the carnivals are doing well, and I think the concessionaires especially are really doing well. A lot of them, they're, like you said, they're buying the trailers, they're buying your products, they're doing everything they need to be doing. I wonder a little bit how much prices can continue to rise so much, and then our customers continue to come back. So far, it's held up pretty good. And you know, history, I read about, also in that Conklin book, I read about World War II, and same thing happened. There was a big bump, supply chain issues. You know, it was like I was reading about the pandemic. If I just substitute war for pandemic, it would almost been the same thing. But there was a bump, and you know, things stayed up, but maybe it'll stay up. I don't know. But I'm always a little cautious that, you know, how often you spend, like you said, the fries went from, you know, $2 to $10 or whatever, because you put them in a bucket, which is great. But,
one thing I noted though, once COVID hit, it seemed like it numbed everybody as far as what to pay for something.
Yeah.
In other words, you know, there was a time when gas was like in the $2 range. Now it's in the $3 range, whatever. But no matter what the price is on anything anymore, people would accept it. It's like, oh, okay. If you want it, you got to pay for it.
And, yeah. And so you don't have enough money left to buy it. Then you don't go.
Well, that's an issue too.
Because I mean, I'm a firm believer in fairs, and I run the fair side of things a lot too. In addition to the car, I've run a lot of events, and you know, we need volume. We can't work not on volume. You know, it's like, you don't want one person at $100, you want 100 people at $1 to come through, you know, in general, when you're doing those things. So, you know, you want people to come multiple times, you want them to be able to come back, and that sort of has, you know, elasticity with the price. You know, the price is going to drive those things to a certain extent. I mean, it's great if you just save up to go one day, but that's not going to make the concessionaires happy. That's not going to make anybody happy in the long run.
Oh, yeah.
Not an easy thing. So what's next for Burke? You got anything new on the line?
Well, let me think about that.
Close us out to get us all excited here.
Well, we're always adding new pinball machines for our arcade. But
if you made a pinball cup for the amusement industry, it'd be fun. They sell at the concession stands.
Well, I never thought about that.
But like we have a famous guest.
We do have plush, and the plush is interesting. We have a little character called Flippy. It's our little plush animal we have at our arcade, but he's in the shape of a flipper, so that's been fun.
I bet you a pinball themed cup would be pretty fun.
I don't know how would you plunge the ball, or where would the ball go? I don't know.
No ball, just a cup with like pictures of arcade games or pinball machines, like. People love that stuff. They're nostalgic for it, you know? It'd be fun.
Well, my friend, let's give me an order on the air right now. 5,000 cups, we'll do it.
Cup.
By the way, we have our own internal art department. We have our own internal art department, so a lot of times people don't know what kind of designs to make or what they should do. So we can create it for you. So we do it as a no-charge opportunity for you guys to come up with a design that you're happy with. So. Just FYI.
I got you. And you're continuing to innovate when there's new foods or new whatever, ways to package them, ways to sell them, ways to serve them.
Yep. So we're working on a couple of new products now. We're going to wait to see if the check to see how the manufacturer of it goes and so forth. But, you know, there's always something new we'll be introducing. So stand by and get ready. I guess that's the best thing I can tell you about that.
There's always something new going on at Burke Concession Supply. Is Riley like into starting new things or introducing new products? Or
well, you know, she's still a rookie at it, so she's kind of getting her feet wet. But you can't help it. The more you're into it, the more you get some ideas. Yeah, maybe I could do this. You know, maybe we're always brainstorming some ideas. I mean, we have this one deal. We call it the bath. It's a tub of fun. We call it tub of fun. It's a bathtub-looking container with two handles on it. And it's a bizarre-looking thing that we saw on the West Coast. And there's a guy that we sell to here in the Pennsylvania area. And he said, let me try a couple of cases. Well, you know, it's one of those situations where those two cases that send me 100 cases. So, you know, you just never know. You know, people are always looking for something different. Even the bucket of fries. They're probably getting tired of looking at the bucket. So, hey, what else can you do? What other container can you put the bucket in or the fries in? So that's like this tub of fun we have. You know, you could put the fries in there. So
you got to keep looking at the stuff. So there's no new Rob Burke that comes around and says, you know, I'm going to innovate and make a new cup that nobody's thinking of yet. You got to continue to
stuff
and innovate new things and continue to do all the things you've been doing. Well, Rob, you know, your fascinating history. One of the people, you know, that changed so much and that people don't really realize, you know, when they see things in the Midway and the cups and the different things and all the
innovations. This is where it all started. You know, even the cotton candy bags. You know, Gold Medal was the first guy to have the monster bag. They called it. You know, for their
large, the big one, yeah.
And we came up with a design called the Bagosaurus. So you know, something that kids would like. And then we've tried some different sizes of cotton candy bags, and they've been lukewarm results. But always trying to innovate and think of something new and different. Not everyone's a hit, but we're always trying.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. I'm going to get out to see that arcade. I'm excited now.
Well, you're welcome. Everyone that sees this broadcast, if they mention they saw the broadcast, we'll give them a special VIP price.
Nice. VIPs. Well, thanks so much for coming on, Rob. I appreciate it. And your dog.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Get a special appearance. We'll talk to you very soon.
All right, buddy. All the best.
Thanks a lot.
Take care.
This podcast is brought to you by Innovative Ticketing is the ticketing source made for the amusement industry. Our staff of professionals can guide you through your setup, assist with customer service, even on the weekends when you most need it, and help increase your sales through promotions that work. Innovative Ticketing is the ticketing source made for the amusement industry. Sign up today at innovativeticketing.com.